Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Ludden. This is Open Source. Remember the shift in Beatles hits of the 1960s? I Want to Hold Your Hand from 63 was a hymn to togetherness. Eleanor Rigby in 66 was about all the lonely people. By 1970, the song was I, Me, Mine. There's a turn in those lyrics away from trust, engagement, social empathy. And for our guest Robert Putnam and his co-writer Shailen Romney Garrett, there's a key to the anxious American doldrums of 2020. Politics broken, economy gasping, public health missing, social capital depleted. Their book is upbeat in a downbeat time. It's titled The Upswing. We're an individualistic society with a communitarian streak, or maybe vice versa. But the I and me impulses are always in struggle with the we, in we the people. What's crashing all around us, Putnam and Garrett argue, is the second gilded age of I alone, monopoly wealth, and much social misery. They're here to remind us that the first gilded age was much the same, or worse, in the 1890s. And it got cured in the 20th century by a parade of common causes, like public high school for everybody, progressive taxation on monster money, and strong unions to the peak of a shared prosperity in the 1950s post-war, and JFK's 1960 spirit of ask what you can do for your country. It's been downhill ever since in the tax cuts of the 1980s, austerity, precarity, and Lily Tomlin's line, just remember, we're all in this alone. I'm asking Shailen Garrett and Bob Putnam, for starters, to diagnose the American condition in 2020 for a bumper sticker.
America is in a downward drift. It's not something that's happened recently. It's something that's been happening since roughly the mid-1960s. We are heading further down a darkening path that we have been on for quite a long time. And we are poised, I would hope, to gain some mastery over that drift. Tragic optimism is a concept that I've been working with a lot lately. Tragic optimism means being very, very realistic about how broken and dark the place is that we are in. But even in that realism, finding some hope to hold on to that things can and will change.
Your diagnosis, Bob Putnam.
Well, I'm actually more optimistic, maybe a little more optimistic than Shailen, but more optimistic about the future of America than I have ever been in my entire life, Chris. Mm. I think the country is about to enter a long period, decades-long period of improvement in many, many respects. Mm. I'm optimistic because of what we know about the past.
I would add my own sense of our condition. It's late imperial. It's scared. We're waking up in a good sense, but on the wrong side of the bed. We're not broken, but we're stuck.
That is true that the United States has gotten more unequal in the last 50 years. That's one of the things we're emphasizing. But that's not the only way in which it's changed. The United States has gotten also much less connected with one another. The formation of American families have changed over this period. The degree to which we either connect with other people in our communities or don't connect with other people has changed dramatically since 1970.
Let's talk the history. The news, the shock in your book is that we've been here before. We showed most of the same symptoms in 1890, at the peak of the Gilded Age, Mark Twain's title, peak fortunes of the great building of America, railroads, oil, banking, cotton. And now the second Gilded Age, awash in the profit of a lot of it selling off that economy. Between then and now, my lifetime and yours, we had a much more equal, long uptrend in egalitarian community, a we society more than I society. And you're suggesting that we could have it again.
The shift that we document from an incredibly unequal society in the last Gilded Age toward a more equal society at mid-century in America was driven by, certainly accompanied by, underlying cultural shifts that asked people to question whether it was in line with the values we wanted America to be built upon, to allow certain people to be so vastly more rewarded than others, or whether we wanted to share the pie. And I say wanted to share the pie because there's nothing inevitable about these shifts, right? We make choices as a society about the values that we emphasize, and those choices radiate into everything. They radiate into economics, they radiate into politics, they radiate into our families. And I think that we've seen a real shift from what we call an I ethos in the last Gilded Age toward an ever-increasing we ethos, which we saw at its peak at mid-century in America. And since then, we have been in a downward drift back toward an I ethos. So the question is whether we will choose to shift in the other direction yet again.
The news of this book is we've been here before. An incredible number, a checklist of symptoms, including corporate wealth, technological discovery, technological advance, but also extreme wealth, showy wealth, political wealth. We've been there and somehow we recovered.
Let me paint that picture for you a little bit, Chris. At the turn of the 20th century, Americans were experiencing greater material well-being than they'd ever experienced before. They were experiencing greater health than they had ever experienced before. They were experiencing more educational opportunities than they had ever experienced before. They were experiencing enormous shifts in technology that were changing their lives in ways that the generation before never thought possible. Does that sound a little bit familiar as a context? Of course it does, right? But here are the things that accompanied that: extreme income inequality and class segregation, an economy ruled by corporate monopolies that were only growing in size and power, workers powerless to negotiate for themselves, a largely unregulated economy, contaminated products getting into the marketplace, raw materials being gobbled up, and then in politics, a relentless zero-sum power struggle. Repeated failure of compromise in an extremely polarized environment. Third parties became a popular option because everybody felt like the two parties that were in power were doing nothing. Cynicism about a rigged system. Also, we saw nativism, suspicion of immigrants, loneliness and isolation, and a pervading disillusionment and despair. We also saw something called social Darwinism, which was a culture of extreme self-reliance. We saw in the last Gilded Age scandals dominating the media. Crime and moral decay were the subjects of popular entertainment. Widespread drug and alcohol abuse, substance abuse was a huge feature of the last Gilded Age. Consumerism and materialism were dominating our culture. There was this fevered pace, this anxiety that people couldn't keep up. And there was a great nostalgia for a bygone era. Does that sound familiar as well? It was a great nostalgia for a time when America was in a golden age and what had happened to that. And of course, there was great racism and gender discrimination, which of course had always been a part of the American story, but in this period, arguably, were on the rise after having gotten a little bit better during Reconstruction. And you had a whole host of commentators at the turn of the last century decrying the decay and foretelling disaster.
You can make one single great arch of all these numbers, and they move together and reinforce each other. More equal incomes becomes the trend, more collaborative politics, social cohesion, altruistic ideals in personal life, and you see it building from the 19-teens and 20s. I had forgotten that in 1912, three presidential candidates, William Howard Taft, Teddy Roosevelt, and Woodrow Wilson, all called themselves progressives. How did we get there? And are you suggesting that you can cure our affliction again? Bob?
Yes, we are. The election of 1912 allows us to emphasize another feature of that progressive period that sometimes people miss. National charismatic political leadership, exemplified in Teddy Roosevelt then.
I noticed that. Politics seems to be the trail end of this of the story.
Absolutely. And that, think about what that means in the following sense, Chris. First of all, to remind your listeners, Teddy Roosevelt, who was in that famous election in 1912, ordinary people in ordinary towns all across America had by then been working on these reforms for 20 or 30 years. The reforms came from the bottom up. And as I say, the national political leadership was a lagging variable. I'm not saying it was unimportant, of course not. But that's not where the impetus came from. That's not where the... If you're looking to see where the vitality or where the likelihood of a new progressive era might come from now, it's not found in Cambridge, and it's not found in Seattle, and it's not found in, you know, New York City or Washington. It's found in ordinary places. The last time it was places like Toledo and Galveston and, you know, East Elbow, Iowa, places you've never, ever heard of. The reason I mention these small towns in Iowa is that is where, for example, the public high school was invented in small towns, tiny towns, in rural Iowa and Kansas. Tiny towns.
Right.
And that was a huge change, an enormous change, because the first time in world history, I'm choosing my words carefully, the first time in world history that all kids in town, just because they live there, were promised a free four-year secondary education. And no one had ever heard of that. Of course, there were secondary schools, but they were private. Public high schools did not exist until that period, roughly speaking, 1910, within a couple of years of that. And then the ideal went viral instantly. I mean, amazing. Started in a couple of small towns in Iowa in 1910, and within 20 years, every community in America had a high school.
High school education for everybody, all over the country, preparation for work, for middle-class life. What could have been so powerful to make a together society? There were other things like income taxes
sure.
being graduated heavily against big wealth. But that great convergence goes right straight to 1970. And by then, even the Jim Crow segregation of Black America was breaking down. What happened then?
It's only as we have widened the temporal scope of this project, not for the last 50 years, but the last 125 years, that I see there were two turning points in this period we're talking about. There was a turning point around 1900, 1910, and there was a turning point in 1965. If we want to fix things, then we don't want to worry about how did we come down from some imagined golden age in the 50s. Rather, we want to ask the people at the first turning point, that is at the progressive era, they actually did it. And we can learn a lot more from looking at what their experiences than we could by looking back at the peak. We could have written the same book and said, talked about the downswing or something, but we didn't because we want to make a difference. We want to change America. Chris, you know about my work going way back. I like to be a scholar. I like to be a serious scholar, but I want to end my life and career helping to change America, and that we're not going to do by imagining some golden age.
Coming up, what gets an upswing started? This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The Putnam-Garrett line on upswings is that they don't start with Washington politics or charismatic stars or mere economics. What's driven our history is social ideals and values. The revolution we should be looking for today is a revolution of the heart.
We found some real surprises when we looked at the long-run data for both race and gender. It's undeniable, of course, that as the 19th century ended, the outlook for African Americans in this country was incredibly bleak. Reconstruction had basically been abandoned and been replaced by what historians have called Southern redemption, when white Northerners sort of looked the other way and Southerners violently reclaimed dominance. And then the question is what happened next? Because when you think about common histories of the 20th century, when you think about race, you think, well, sort of, we think of Jim Crow, right? We think that everything was discrimination and oppression for the first two-thirds of the century up until we get to the lightning bolt changes of the 1960s and things get suddenly and dramatically better. And in many ways, that story is true, particularly when it comes to, you know, things like Blacks being excluded from professional schools and therefore professions, when we think about white supremacy dominating the media, when we think about the persistent lack of equity in Black political representation. Well, it turns out that when you look at data related to the material progress of Black Americans against the material progress of white Americans, you see a remarkably different shape to the trend. When we look at things like health, life expectancy, infant mortality, when you look at things like education, which is attendance at school, completion of high school degrees, college degrees, when you look at things like income, relative income between Blacks and whites, when you look at relative wealth of Blacks and whites, home ownership and things like that, and when you look at things like voter registration and voter participation, what you actually see is steady progress toward parity with whites. That happened actually from roughly 1900 till about 1970. And that is a very different, very surprising story, right? Because the question then becomes, well, if, you know, there was this very persistent reality of exclusion, the progress that Blacks were making was made in separate spheres. So how is it that Black Americans were making progress relative to white Americans on these measures of material well-being? Well, it turns out that they were voting with their feet. In a sense, they were leaving the highly discriminatory, violent South for the slightly more hospitable North through the Great Migration. So millions upon millions of African Americans leaving the South for the North and raising their own prospects for claiming their place in the American we. That plays out in the data. But what also plays out in the data is that right at 1970, you would think that this march, this long-standing march toward parity would have accelerated. Well, in fact, it stagnated, flatlined, and in some cases reversed. So that in some cases, Black Americans are doing worse today than they were doing in 1970, 1968.
Bob, you wanted to get back to what got the upswing started. I'd love to hear more of that history. The history of the Great Convergence.
The Great Convergence, which originally was a term invented by economists, economic historians, to talk about this remarkable period in which the gap between rich and poor steadily shrank. That's what economic historians know as the Great Convergence. And it's always been a puzzle for economic historians. Why did that happen? To the extent that you can, you know, read the tea leaves and squeeze the data and try to see, well, come on, tell me, which was the leading variable or the lagging variable? The only thing you can be sure of is economics lagged. This was not a story about economics causing everything else. This was a story about other things, cultural, sociological, political, that influenced economics. It looks like the earliest variable to move, that is the one that must have been implicated in the initial movement of the progressive era, was cultural. We should be worrying about cultural change and moral change and value change in America.
Trace the cultural moral impulse in the early part of this century.
Some of the most articulate voices in the progressive era calling for the kind of moral and cultural shift that we think may have led this change were the social gospelers. They were preachers, but often lay people as well, who were starting to say, enough with the social Darwinism. We need a different conception here of how society actually works. We need to repudiate the dog-eat-dog idea and realize that something else might drive us all forward better. And, you know, Washington Gladden was one of the most famous of these social gospelers. He wrote that it is idle to imagine that changes in our governmental machinery or in the organization of our industries will bring us peace. The trouble lies deeper in our primary conceptions. We have got to have a different kind of men and women, which I think is such a beautiful articulation of exactly what we're talking about. We can tinker with this other stuff, politics and economics, and we do endlessly as a society. But what we're less good at is figuring out how to create the moral shifts inside of people that then precipitate in them different types of choices. That's what we're really looking for. One of my favorite reformers, Dorothy Day, who came after the progressives but was certainly inspired by them, put it this way: what we need is a revolution of the heart. This does play out in concrete material terms. And one of the stories that we tell in the book, which I love, and I love it especially because it's my own family that it describes. So I'm a Romney. That's my maiden name. I'm from the same Romney line, from the same family line as George and Mitt Romney. They're cousins of my grandfather and my father. So, you know, we don't hang out at Thanksgiving together, but we are from the same family. And when you look at George Romney, he was both a very successful businessman and a politician. He was considered, you know, a leader in America at mid-century. And he repeated...
I remember him well, American Motors and the governor
right.
of Michigan.
So what was the ethos that governed his behavior as a CEO? He repeatedly turned down bonuses because he didn't want to encourage, as he put it, a culture of greed in his organization. He could have enriched himself. His company was trying to give him, you know, what they thought he deserved. And he said, you know what, that's making that gap between me and the average worker so big as to be outrageous is really not good for society. So I'm not going to do that.
It's immoral.
It's immoral. And that and that was not, and let's be clear here, that was not an outlier. If you look at some of the work that Paul Krugman has done and Robert Reich, they've shown countless examples of this ethos amongst leaders and CEOs in that period. Fast forward to Mitt Romney, George's son, who also extremely successful businessman, also a politician, repeatedly took millions upon millions of dollars in bonuses, thinking that that was perfectly fine because that's how the economy works. And not only that, but then gets on a national stage and says, there's 47% of this country who are nothing but moochers and taking advantage.
Makers and takers.
Makers and takers, and you're one or the other. And that represents a fundamentally different type of man or woman in terms of that person's primary conceptions about who we are, whether we have an obligation to share and lift one another up, or whether we should just take as much as we can get and condemn everyone else around us, right? And I think that that is an example of a cultural shift that is deeply intertwined with something like income inequality.
Shailen Romney Garrett, thank you. Fascinating story. Do you want to burnish that, Bob Putnam?
You can see the changes that we're talking about in religious involvement. Not with respect to theology. It's not like theology is frankly not so relevant to this. I mean, maybe it's relevant to our eternal fate, but it's not relevant to American society in the same way as religion as a community. Religious communities have waxed and waned and have had powerful effects, actually. The place where American religion has seemed to be most influential recently was actually in the part of the religious firmament that has been sort of, in some sense, we-focused. But I want to go back to the earlier evangelicals, because in that period, who were the leading people who were the first to begin to cry out about inequalities? They were evangelical Protestants, not the people you'd normally think of nowadays as being the leaders in a fight for equality, but they were. And I just have to tell one story. I think all you know, people who pay attention to religion in America know the expression, what would Jesus do? That term, what would Jesus do, was invented by an evangelical in 1906, I think. And he invented it not as a peon to conservatism. What he meant, he wrote a whole novel about this. And in his novel, Jesus is wandering the Midwest and he comes to the, you know, some town. And as was true in the times, you know, up on the bluffs where the rich folks, that's where all the church people were. And that's where the good thinking people were. And then down along the valley below on the floodplain were, you know, the poor people. This guy, this evangelical preacher and novelist, wrote this novel saying, what would Jesus do if he came here today? And the whole point of that, what would Jesus do, was Jesus was sure as heck not be with the rich folks up on the bluffs. He'd be down with the poor folks. And that idea that religion can have a dramatically progressive impact is really powerful. And if you think I'm just talking history, you've not been paying attention to the Vatican recently, because Pope Francis is exactly that figure.
And another great example of this is the Reverend William Barber, who's leading something called the Poor People's Campaign. He's picking up on the work that Martin Luther King was about to begin doing when he was assassinated. And he's conducting these moral marches on Washington all the time now, trying to bring attention to the fact that, you know, inequality is not just a social problem, it's a moral problem.
The social gospel was a progressive movement in the early part of the century. It's what produced George McGovern in South Dakota. That spirit of creating a world society that Jesus might bless. So strange. I mean, Amy Coney Barrett, nominated for the Supreme Court, is in trouble in some circles for saying to students not so long ago that what we're about in this world is building a kingdom of God, building the kingdom of God. Where does that fit in?
First of all, I'm not trying to take a stand on her particular nomination. No, no, no. I have views about it, but that is not about that. She represents what happened to American religion, beginning actually around the 1960s, as it moved in an I direction. And there are other people, even now, who have a very different view of the role of religion. You can easily think, Chris, and you know some of these people, who are very fervent Christians, really seriously fervent Christians, but who are, if I can put it this way, we Christians, and they are appalled by her nomination. Our argument is not that, it's certainly not that religion is always a force for progress, but we do argue that there are times when religion, far from its traditional role as a comforter of the powerful, switches and becomes, you know, in that famous phrase, to comfort the afflicted and afflict the powerful. Cultural and value change are leading variables and help actually to shape the conversation in, you know, more practical things like what do we do about the income tax or how about minimum wage or whatever.
And maybe to just reframe this for some of your listeners that might be squirming, you know, thinking about this in terms of religion, what we're really talking about here is moral formation. The role of religion, of religious congregations to engage in active moral formation. And religious organizations are not the only organizations that can do this, right? There's a lot going on in America today that's highly innovative around the idea of how do we engage in active collective moral formation for people who consider themselves to be secular. And a lot of those efforts are helping people to rally around America's we values. Rally around the idea of America that is more about our responsibilities to each other and less about our individual rights. So there's lots of places where these conversations are being started around how do we reimagine our moral values and how do we reimagine the institutions that we build based upon those moral values.
We recognize that what we're saying, indeed we proclaim that what we're saying is going to sound weird, especially to our progressive friends in our little corner of America. And we're doing that because we think that our friends ought to understand that engaging with moral discourse and even engaging with some forms of religious discourse is a prerequisite for moving in the direction we want to go. I mean, I'm certainly not saying everybody in America, every progressive in America has to become religious, but I'm insisting to my friends that don't discount the importance of values and culture. I know it sounds to our ears like that's crazy.
No, not to mine.
Values and morals are an essential part. I don't want to say the only part, but an essential part of turning this country around.
It always comes back to the 60s in some fashion, the time when everything that could happen did happen. You remind me those years of hope, days of rage. Todd Gitlin, I think, gets credit for that. But in what sense was this distemper born in the 60s? Are we still dealing with the 60s?
Certainly you and I, our people of our generation, are for sure going to be dealing with the 60s all our lives because it was the most influential period. Almost anybody, no matter what their politics, who came of age in the 60s, it was the most important period that they'll ever experience. That's just a fact. America entered the 60s in a very we mood. The first half of that period, from roughly 1960 to or thereabouts to 1964, was a period of great optimism. I remember that very vividly because I was standing in the back of the crowd on the east front of the Capitol in January 19th, 1961. We heard Jack Kennedy say with our own ears, we heard him say, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. The hair on the back of my neck still gets rise because that was a hugely important moment. I thought Kennedy was speaking directly to me, and I won't go through the details, but that moment changed my life. It's what turned me into a social scientist interested in social change. And at the time we thought, actually all of us thought, that Jack Kennedy was sounding reveille, wake up, for a new period of American history, because that's what the feeling at the time was. Now, in historical terms, we know right after that moment, the second half of this occurred, and that far from, you know, being a symbol of what's about to happen and, you know, great further things, it was a sad taps And I mean, sadly, of course, he himself heard those taps 3 years later, which is another part of that turning point. And then we came out of the 60s in exactly the opposite direction. And the turning point can be amazingly, you can, in popular culture, you can see it. You go through the Beatles songs and you can see that up in the early 60s, up until about 1963, they were all singing about togetherness and Let Me Hold Your Hand, and all their songs were this kind of we-ness. And then on a dime, they turned, and the second half of the 60s was symbolized by the fact that their very last record ever produced, I'm going to recite for you or your listeners, the lyrics of the very last song the Beatles ever recorded together. I, me, mine, I, me, mine, I, me, mine. That's the whole song.
Mm.
It was sung by someone who was disillusioned with what another member of the Beatles was about to do. And 6 months later, he went off on his own. His first song was, I don't care about Beatles, I care about me.
That was a fellow named John Lennon, as I remember.
John Lennon's very first single said, I don't believe in Beatles, I believe in me. One of the things that I'm trying to say is, how did it happen that we came into the 60s in this really amazingly rapid upswing, and then halfway through it, like, we turned like in exactly the opposite direction?
Coming up, complications of war, empire, and globalization. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. It is startling to be reminded in The Upswing by our guests Shailen Garrett and Robert Putnam that four classic books of unsparing social criticism came out at the peak of our togetherness high in the early 60s. Michael Harrington's The Other America about poverty, Rachel Carson's Silent Spring about DDT and the environment, both of those in 1962. Then in 63, James Baldwin's The Fire Next Time and Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique. All of them tough-minded books founded on a broad confidence that big reforms were urgent and thoroughly doable.
Why would you write a book like that unless you thought that, you know, you and your fellow citizens could fix it?
Right.
And not only that, but the amazing thing is those are the same issues that are still on our agenda. We still haven't fixed those issues.
Right.
That is the environment and the inequality and the race and gender, obviously. So, yes, that early period was a period of great optimism, even among people who were radical. They thought
right.
we could do this. We came out of it, of course, in a very different direction. And why that pivot occurred, why that change occurred, is itself a very complicated story. We, even though, as I've said, we're more interested in the earlier pivot, the progressive era, we spent a lot of time also speculating about what could have caused this rapid pivot around 1964. It's actually, Chris, I will tell you, actually, I know secretly what caused that pivot. The pivot occurred in 1964. The date is very clear. All the data show 1964. I personally voted for the first time in 1964. And therefore, I'm confessing now on your show that actually it turns out that I personally caused the collapse of Western civilization.
Will indict
you. By getting involved in public life. So we don't quite know what caused it. It's a concatenation of simultaneous crises that all happened. And there were many, many crises that happened. You know, it's not just the race and not just the gender. And it's also the period of the Vietnam War, which in principle was completely unrelated, although it got wrapped up in this. And it was the period of great economic turmoil with the gas crises, the oil lines, and so on. So there were a lot of, and many others, actually, riots in the cities. That was not related to any of these other things. And drugs was part of it. That was not related to anything else. It was a concatenation of otherwise unrelated events that caused America to have a kind of a nervous breakdown in the middle 60s, and that led to this turn. You can single out some of the important points. Obviously, white backlash against racial progress was a really important part of that turning point. And in that sense, racial resentment has a good claim to be an important part of the reversal in the 60s. And that's why, actually, we think that there's a lot that we need to spend time on, and the country needs to spend, and progressives need to spend time on, reflecting on how it was that the last time we were in a period of weakness, we somehow blew it and got off on this other track.
May I say with respect, I think you underplay the Vietnam War and the Middle East Wars in terms of the changing self-image, the changing sense of ourselves in the world. How can they not be central to the distemper today and the sense that we've lurched out of our exceptional good guy G.I. Joe role into a downward spiral of military empire?
Like you, I actually personally experienced the 60s. So talking about the 60s and how it felt at the time is not something I learned in books. It's my life, right? And it's your life too.
Right.
And I understand what you say, that for many people who experienced it, the Vietnam War was the turning point. However, I've talked to dozens of audiences, and every different member of that generation, of our generation, has their own favorite explanation. And the Vietnam War is an important part of that. But actually, many people say, they don't say it was the Vietnam War, they say it was the assassinations. Because the thing that, from their point of view, triggered everything else was the Kennedy assassination and then the Martin Luther King assassination and so on. And there are other people, honestly, just like us, who think that the most important thing that happened in the 60s, the thing that defined it, was the gas lines and the soaring inflation. Suddenly, your real income was dropping, and you had to wait in line days and days and days to get gas.
Bringing this into, you know, my own lifetime, I've only lived in the midst of the downturn. I didn't experience the we-ness that preceded the I-ness. I've only experienced the I-ness. But even within the I-ness, you know, there were moments, you know, for me, where exactly what you described, moments of deep disillusionment about America was supposed to be the good guy in the world and look at what we're doing. And I think that younger generations have had these moments as well and have asked themselves, what do we do? I mean, because you're talking about these things contributing to a national distemper, right?
Right.
But what do we do in the face of distemper? What is it that we can control? If all these things are sort of drifting downward and they're these big structural problems, where do we enter the story? Are we just sort of subjects in the story, or are we objects? In the midst of these concatenation of crises, and heaven knows we're living through a year, another year that will go down in history as a concatenation of crises, much as, let's say, 1968 was, what do we do in the midst of that? I mean, that to me is the question that should occupy our brightest minds today, and frankly, all of us today.
I also want you to speak to what we're doing. In fact, it is a high season of movement politics, specifically around the climate, the Sunrise Movement particularly, turned Ed Markey's campaign against Joe Kennedy right around. Also BLM, for sure, about race, but also Reverend Barber's Poor People's Campaign about economic equality. These movements have sprung up, and they're telling us something important about the future. Could it be 1910 again?
Yes.
We certainly hope so. And we think that these are some of the brightest signs that we are entering a turning point. But I think that there's also something important to be said, which is that the Progressive Era was the moment when we turned direction. It wasn't the moment when we solved all the problems in a very short period of time. That's the other thing that we learned from the IWI curve, is that in the Progressive Era, it was that we, as Bob likes to put it, we changed the direction of change, which is to say, things were moving in one direction, and we said, okay, things are moving because things are always moving in a society, but we're going to now move in a different direction. And it took a long time for the fruits of that inflection point to really become visible. And let me say, one of the other bright spots with these movements that you've highlighted is that they're incredibly youth-driven.
Yes.
And that was an extraordinarily important feature of the Progressive Era as well. We look at portraits of Jane Addams and we think, oh, she was this nice grandmother who, you know, helps the poor. Well, in fact, she was quite young when she began that. Most of the progressives who were really the movers and shakers in that movement were under the age of 30 when they were doing the most important work that they were doing. Ida B. Wells, who was out crusading against lynching, and Walter Lippmann, who wrote Drift and Mastery, one of the key texts that helped push the Progressive Era forward, was 25 when he wrote that. So that is incredibly analogous to what we're seeing today, where young people are the ones embracing their role in bringing about the future of America. But one thing that worries me, about young people leading these movements is that we have a generation of young people who are a bit impatient, right? For lots of reasons, technological change and other things that make it seem like things should happen fast. And if they don't happen fast, we get really disillusioned, right? And think, well, it's just not worth it. And I think there's a danger there. And I do think this is where a long view of history is really important. That even if you don't see the change happen in the next year, in the next 5 years, in the next 10 years, even if you don't necessarily see it in your own lifetime, this is still the fight that we have to fight, because this is a we fight. And that we goes not only across class boundaries and not only across race boundaries, it also goes across generational boundaries, right? I'm the mother of young children. The work that I am doing is maybe not going to benefit me in my own lifetime. I might have to live through a dark period for the next decade or two, but I do that work because I want to create a world for them to live in that is in an upswing. And I would call upon our young people today to make sure that they are widening their time horizon a bit in terms of their expectations. When you're talking about riding a ship as big and as complicated as American society, that takes a while, and we have to stay at it. And I would also just highlight here that, you know, social networks and online networking and these sorts of things are going to be incredibly important parts of this upswing. We've seen that they've been incredibly important parts of the Me Too movement and the Black Lives Matter movement and all of these things. But if there's one thing that sociologists have learned over the past decade or so about movements that are driven highly by social media is that they're very fragile, because they're not necessarily undergirded by the face-to-face connections and networks that then provide the muscle and the social capital to build something new. So it's pretty easy to tear things down using Twitter, but what do you use to build them back up? So I would also hope that our movement leaders today are spending as much time building face-to-face coalitions and networks that are going to be there to rebuild America as much as they're spending time, you know, calling out hypocrisy and calling out moral decay, which is incredibly important. But we also need those boots on the ground of people who are going to be there holding hands, physically holding hands, when we're able to do that again once COVID is over, to rebuild, not rebuild, but let's say build the America that has not yet existed, an America that is a we America that is fully inclusive.
The most exciting thing about this book is an air of expectation with which we come to an end. Since you sent it to the printer, not only the crises have deepened, but we can see a response by thousands, maybe millions of young people with a plan. Speak of that as a kind of fulfillment of what you had in mind. What are the movements out there? What are the trends since you wrote the book that say you are onto something, including an upswing?
It is an interesting way to summarize all of this. When we finished this book, it was only, it's hard to say, it was only like 8 or 9 months ago, we were writing for, in the hopes that we could stir the imaginations of a generation of young people who would then, over the succeeding decade or two, get inspired and go out and change America. But then all that's happened since the book has happened. And suddenly we find ourselves in a world in which our title in this book is not an aspiration for the distant future. We may be actually almost at the upswing. We may be almost at the period, depending on the outcome of the election, of course, could easily be in a period in which the upswing, the book, the upswing is not a prediction about the past, but actually a kind of a guide for the future, because the same things we talked about in this book written 9 months ago will turn out to be on the agenda of a new progressive administration. Neither of us expected that when we started writing the book. Of course, we didn't have bold enough aspirations, I guess. Shannon, what do you feel about it?
I would just add to that, that I share that optimism, but I also know that nothing is inevitable.
Sure.
That should we get overconfident and say, oh, this thing is changing itself and we just have to sort of ride it into the future, which is, of course, not what Bob is saying at all. It's not what we're saying in the book, but it is. I can hear the way in which it's possible to hear it that way as one of your listeners, right? what we're optimistic about is that more and more people are getting out into the streets and protesting, more and more people are getting out into those laboratories of democracy and tinkering around with what the solutions will be. That cannot stop. It has to multiply tenfold, a hundredfold, a thousandfold before we're really going to see what we need to see. And so we're optimistic. We think we're on the front end of change, but that change will only be driven forward into a full upswing if everyone within the sound of our voices gets out there and builds it.
I can actually just add a very final footnote to that. The difference between us in the degree of our optimism, there is actually a difference between us in the degree of our optimism. I'm 80. I don't have years to wait until we get this country back on the right track. I want to have it happen now, so I will personally see it. And, you know, my life expectancy, well, it's not zero, but it's not 20 or 30 years. Xi Lin has 50 years ahead of us, and she can afford to be a little more relaxed about this. I want to have it to happen now.
Xi Lin, you're right that issues of race and gender could be the master cause of the curve, up and down. Explain that.
Sure. I mean, I think going back to the question of moral awakening, when it comes to equalization, when it comes to inclusion, it's very easy to be in favor of ideas. It's more difficult to be in favor of structural change or change that requires sacrifice on my part, right? So the question is not, are we going to get out there behind some ideological or ideal standard bearer? The question is whether we're willing to sort of show up and lay our own privilege down on the altar of progress, which, you know, in the 1960s, for certain, white Americans showed very clearly that they were not willing to do. And so I think this, again, is where we tie back into what we need is a revolution of the heart. We need a revolution in terms of what's going on inside of us that will allow us to make some more room. And when I say us, I'm talking about white Americans, because that's what I am, right? Will we make more room at the table? Will we be willing to give up some of our privilege so that everyone else can have a little bit more? I do think that that's absolutely central to what happened in the 1960s. And I think it will be central to whatever type of upswing we might build going forward.
Looking for causes of whatever we call it, the distemper today, you make an arresting point that global trade and immigration, which were very, very low from the 20s to the 60s and up sharply since the 70s, they're a problem for togetherness. You write, global flows of goods and people are part of the downturn pattern from we to I. Does it have to be that way? What's to be done about that?
Saying no to immigration, of course, is one of those parts of the progressive era that is indicative of the fact that progressives had a circle of moral concern that was way too small. And I think, you know, what we are trying to do as a nation is, in the words of Eric Liu, who runs Citizen University, we are trying to create the world's first mass multicultural democracy. This is something that has not ever been done before. We need to remind ourselves of the enormity of what we've taken on as a nation. There's no template for this, right? It's easy to create a democracy when people are largely homogenous. It's very difficult to do that when people are very, very different. And I think young people today have the equipment to be innovative around how we do inclusion, much more so than anyone in generations that have come before. You know, young people today don't need racial sensitivity training. They inherently understand the need for inclusion much more so than generations that went before them. And I think I look to them for the ideas, the narratives, and the institutions that are going to create this fully inclusive upturn that has not only to do with race, but has to do with immigration as well.
Well said. Shannon Garrett and Bob Putnam, thank you. Thank you for this book, and thank you for preaching it to us.
Thank you, Chris. It's been a pleasure to be here, and we are hoping that we are going to see another American upswing.
Bob Putnam's book with Xi Lin Romney Garrett is titled Upswing. Swing on over to radioopensource.org for loads more conversation on our website. And while you're there, think of leaving a tip for the hardest working team in radio. You can also support Open Source by becoming a monthly subscriber on Patreon, where you'll find a growing audio library of conversations, including Adam Coleman's ongoing series of interviews about writing in a time of social distance. This week, he's talking with Kirsten Valdez-Quaid about short stories and short attention spans. Find that conversation at patreon.com/radioopensource. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies and Adam Coleman. Max Liebman engineered. Mary McGrath is our upswing. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time for Open Source.